listeners, and welcome back to the Thinking Time Wasters Pop Culture Talk Show. This is show 101, so we thought about putting all the most horrible things in the world into it, like a collection of Libertines B-sides, for instance, or perhaps Transformers 8, Craptimus Prime. But we thought not. Instead, we're going to do a normal show. I'm Andrew Harrison, and with me, as ever, is Sean Pattenden, the level-headed Ruth Langsford to my blustering Eamon Holmes. Hello, Sean. How you doing?
I'm all right. Been online shopping at LK Bennett this week.
Did you get anything nice?
Yeah, Amber Rudd tells me it's so easy.
How easy is it? Is it easier than kicking out people who've been in the country for 40 years?
It's so much easier than the hostile environment. It's been great.
Lovely. You've been exploring the Sting and Shaggy album for us, so thanks for taking one for the team. We'll be discussing that later. We have two special guests with us this week. Michael Smiley is the actor otherwise known as Tyres from Spaced, or DS Benny Silver from Luther, or Gal from Kill List, or Frank from Free Fire, or Eddie from Jawbone. Or if you're old enough, that mad, bald Irish raver comedian on Naked City. He's also a playwright, a cyclist in real life, a northern soul fiend, and a recovering stand-up comedian. Hello, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm very well, Andrew. Thanks very much.
Welcome to our baking pleasure dome in London.
I'm loving it. It feels like a gilded balloon venue in August.
Yes.
And there's already been 60 different shows through it already.
Yeah, the sweat of desperate comedians trying to make their mark.
Yeah, I feel like I'm hiding in a dancer's cupboard.
I think that was one of Sting's albums, wasn't it, actually?
Yeah, hiding in a dancer's cupboard.
Hiding it, yeah.
Or was it Roddy Frame? It was one of those two, anyway.
Absolutely, yes. I was kind of joking about, like, the fella who'll shoot you, have you cornered in you've cornered the market for a certain kind of hard-faced individual. But do you ever yearn for a kind of provincial doctor or a flower arranger in your CV?
Sometimes. You know me a long time. I'm quite the romantic. So I'm still hanging tough for one of those period dramas set in Northern Ireland at the turn of the 19th century.
Yes.
Where I'm the fop that rides into town and sweeps the young lady off her feet. I'm waiting for that.
I saw that you did Tulip Fever with Alicia Vikander and Judi Dench.
Yes.
Do you go on a wild killing spree in the
with
in
Judi Dench?
Amsterdam? Yes.
Me and Judi just go lopping the tops of tulips.
Beheading.
That was a day.
Cackling.
I tell you what, she's lighting the loafer.
Does she do all her own stunts?
She does every one of her own stunts.
Yeah.
Every one of her own stunts, even the knife fight.
Yeah. When she flies over that phaeton in slow motion to keep her head off her tulip sales.
Well, you can tell because she's got one slightly swollen ankle, and that's how you know it's not the stunt guy.
What have you got coming up next? Because I know you mentioned that you've got this film that you're writing about a bloke who relies too much on his music collection.
Yeah.
I've
written a first draft of a feature film called Hireth, which is a Welsh word, H-I-R-A-E-T-H, which is about a yearning and for a time gone past or a person or a place or a thing. It's a homesickness for a feeling of a time. And it's about a bloke living in London who goes back to Northern Ireland after 30 years. He ran away 30 years ago and he's going back to sort of try and make amends. And he falls in love when he's over there. So nobody's casting me, so I've actually cast myself as a middle-aged lovelorn older man.
Well, you know, you've got a job doing, you've got to do it yourself.
Exactamundo.
What's the relying too much on his music element?
Well, because of my age group, there was that thing of, that awkwardness, that sort of awkwardness of the opposite sex and not being able to talk to girls properly or not being able to, especially when you were 15, 16. So when the music centre came along, so you had the turntable, the radio and the cassette deck all in one, you could record stuff. So that was the birth of the compilation. So I used to make tapes up for girls that I liked.
Yeah.
And sort of try and wangle my way into their affections that way, going, I'm quite awkward, but Curtis Mayfield could say it for me. And Francis Rossi from Status Quo.
There you go. Well, we could talk about this
maybe
a little bit later in more detail. Later on, we're also going to
be
doing a kind of Desert Island Lovies routine. As Smiley tells us what tunes inspired him in various roles. Hold tight, there's a lot of acid house. Sean, who's our other guest on the show?
Well, funny you should say that, Andrew. Also with us today is Sarah Morgan, comedy writer and recovering journalist. After cutting her teeth on Loaded, Bliss and InStyle magazine, Sarah wisely rejected Dead Tree Media for the allure of radio and TV. She's written for Tracy Ullman, Dara O'Brien's School of Hard Sums, Dave Gorman's Modern Life is Goodish, the sitcom Not Going Out, and many of Radio 4 comedy. She also keeps her hand in by writing for The Guardian now and again. How do you get time? Hello, Sarah. Welcome back.
Hello. Nice to be back. Thank you for having me back.
How's your week been?
Yeah, Yeah, lovely. Thank you. I'm doing a lot of writing in my house, so not really going out. So this is exciting. I put on makeup and clothes and left.
You're writing not going out by not going out.
That is quite a lot how we write the show. Yeah. Yeah. If we look for interesting things that have happened to us, the way that we write an episode of Not Going Out is that Lee Mack gets me and Danny, the other writer, to write just a list of things we've had an argument about with our spouse recently, and see if we can get something funny out of that. So an episode that just went out recently is basically a funny thing that happened with me and my lollipop man. So that's always fun, where you can just write down an argument you've had and then see it on the screen. Wow. Just a matter of months later.
It's real.
Yeah. When it goes on the screen, does your other half just turn and give you a stony look and go, you know, what about this?
Yeah, no, I'll buy him something nice.
You just point to the kitchen
and
go,
"Don't worry, Toots. Yeah, I bought you that nice knife you wanted." Maybe I shouldn't buy him knives.
Buy knives.
Yeah, I was going to say,
blender or a coffee machine or something like that.
Yeah, nice Nespresso.
You've written a lot for The Now Show and Mock the Week.
Yes.
How much harder is it now that the real world is beyond comedy?
Yeah, no, that's been... we were talking about this before, weren't we? Writing on the satiricals is really hard because there is not a lot funny going on in the world. I made a blanket rule after Trump got in, which was I'm not going to write any more jokes about what people look like, which is really hard because obviously there's people just present you with these wonderful, but it's quite demeaning if they're a female politician, and B, you're distracting from the terrible, awful things that they're doing. So I won't write a Trump's funny hair joke anymore. I'll try and find, you know, dig a little deeper and find some policy that might be worth taking
an impending nuclear war joke, for instance.
Exactly.
So do you have a list that says Trump, Brexit, Trump, Brexit, Trump, Brexit, insert something else here, can we please?
Yes.
desperate
with something like The Now Show, where we will sit around with all the papers and flick through them going, we kind of have to do this thing because it's the only news story this week, and then you just spend hours staring at your thumbs going, has someone's name changed? Is there something? And then you start going in your old files, looking through old, can I recycle something?
People with Sky and Netflix complain that our TV and radio comedy is really tame compared to The Daily Show or John Oliver because of BBC balance, that sort of thing. Is it going to stay that way? How do you see this panning out?
It's interesting. I think the thing that people don't realise about why John Oliver and Jim Jefferies Show and all these kind of shows are as amazing as they are is they have an astonishing number of writers who work on them, and they also have an astonishing number of researchers. I think John Oliver has more researchers than writers. So they have as much many people finding what the real story is and going deep on it, and then people who will make the funnies, as I was saying before, out of it. So that's why satire is quite hard to do here, because it's money. It's literally money. It's not about tameness. It's not about BBC standards. It's Radio 4 is great for sort of being able to get away with a lot of stuff, but you're writing it with a small group in a short period of time.
So later in the show, let's get back to that. It's 30 whole years since the invention of house music and the Summer of Love. Yes, it's a rave heavy show. It's even got a smiley on it.
Nice.
We will be discussing the panel's formative raving experiences and their favourite classic dance records. And in a terrifying final come down, we will be listening to 44876, the inexplicable collaboration between Sting and Shaggy. All this and more after this brief message.
If you're enjoying Big Mouth, why not show a bit of love by helping us cover the studio costs? We're on the crowdfunding platform Patreon, and you can help by buying us an imaginary, pretend, non-physical pint once a month. A mere £5 a month from 120 listeners will cover all our studio costs. We're aiming for £600 a month to cover all the costs, and we're well on the way. Once we get there, we're going to start doing extra bits each week for Patreon backers. Go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more, and the link's also at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page. All we are saying is, buy us a pint. So, Michael Smiley, we talked about your formative tunes and your the things that influenced you when you got here. And you sent me a terribly interesting list. Start off with something that represents your stand-up years.
Yeah.
And this track is called...
420 Low by Flash and Eddie Fulks.
Wow. 420 Low by Flashing Eddie Fulks, or on the record I had is Eddie Flashing Fulks. Do you think his mum calls him Flashing?
Flashing, come in, your dinner's ready.
Absolutely. Flashing, for God's sake, flashing, stay to this room.
Yeah. So, put your coat on and come in.
So what you moved to London, what was it, 1983, didn't you? And became the stand-up Michael Smiley.
I became the stand-up 10 years later in 93.
Oh, really?
So, no, I'd been living in London for 10 years before I got into performing. I was a cycle courier before that. It wasn't until 93 that I did the Sweet Thinker Funny Newcomers competition in Edinburgh. But I was already going out clubbing and stuff since 88. And had my own little club up underneath the British Telecom Tower at the top of Fitzroy Street.
What was that?
It was under a pub called the Prince Monolulu, who was a tipster, a black African prince tipster. At the race courses, who used to shout, "I've got a horse."
So there was everybody else goes, "So have I." Yeah. It's a race course, mate.
Welcome aboard. But in the basement of that was a little club, which we called Pit Stop. So the idea was you used to go there on a Friday night after work. I'd get you a lock in till 3 a.m. And then we'd lock up, and then we'd go up to the clubs in up around King's Cross and Old Street and stuff like that and party on until the next day.
Good Lord. So this was one of your formative tunes, was it, from those times?
I used to go up to Edinburgh every year, and I used to bring my decks up to Edinburgh, and I used to DJ up at the Gilded Balloon and stuff, to earn some extra cash as well as doing my stand-up. And there was a guy called Big Al. He was one of my mates who was on the door and then became the sound engineer, legendary Big Al. And there's a club up there called Pure, and that's one of the Pure classics.
So
I used to go to Pure with him, and then as a present, he bought me a white label of Flash Nettie Folks.
This is quite hard to find, this one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's not on any of the download stores or anything like that. Mm.
And also, it's just one of those classic bang in your face acid house stuff that just layers and layers and layers. Just when you think, oh, I'm a bit bored with this, something else comes in on the top, which excites you even more. And there's all in my head, the noises I hear become characters. Then I become the character, you know. It's like a little, like an umma-gumma, where it says several furry animals gathered together in a cave and groove with a pict.
Sarah, you're only hearing that on a little tiny Dalek-shaped speaker here. Was it speaking to you?
It was. When we were talking about this, it's like I'm a little bit younger maybe than the rest of the panel, but I was quite a precocious teenager in the 90s. So I sort of came of age raving-wise about 94, 95, but it was in Somerset, so I think it took a bit longer to catch up then anyway. But yeah, certainly it was activating the hairs on my arms in certain exciting ways, unlodging some things that were stuck in my spine since the 90s.
Oh, chiropractic house is definitely a thing that needs to be done. Smiley, another tune. So one of the things that you're kind of known for is Tyres on Space, and particularly the moment where Tyres starts dancing to the kettle, the toaster, the microwave ping going off, which I thought was a very relatable thing. What's the track you chose for your spaced time?
It's called Fever Call Love, the Hard Floor Mix from the Rising High Collective.
Right, let's have a little bit of that.
The entire
studio is bouncing about here, including young Jack, who must have been... How old were you in 1988, producer Jack?
Yeah, -5.
-5.
Good Jack.
It's probably it sort of throbbed into you in the womb. So that's Hard Floor remixing Rising High Collective. That's pure Tyres music, that, isn't it?
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful track. And it was around that time, because Simon and Jess were writing Space, because Simon and I lived together, me and Simon and Nick lived together. I still had my decks and I still had all my tunes, and I was buying a lot of tunes just constantly through the 90s. I was buying lots of tunes in that sort of way of going, they're out there somewhere, the classic tune.
Yeah.
And I started getting into Rising High Collective, and that's slightly slightly more acidy and slightly more Dorsety.
Spit it out. Crusty. It was crusty. Yeah.
But more on the sort of the acid side of house.
Yeah.
You know, more on the ambient side of stuff. I was getting into that. I really liked that. And that tune was just brilliant because there's a female vocals that comes in over the top of it, and then there's a stabbing piano as well. So it nods to Italian house, but it's still got that 808 going through it, which just drives me crazy. Even now I get a wee pseudo rush out of it.
Hardfloor are just ace.
They're brilliant.
All the tracks sound the same, but they all sound brilliant. They're like Status Quo.
Never, ever let you down. They never let you down. When I see a Hardfloor remix, I'll just buy it anyway.
You know? Sarah, are you aware of Hardfloor?
I'm not, I'm afraid. I did watch the episode of Spaced in Question last night again, because I realised it'd probably been a good maybe 5 or 6 years since I watched it. And like I say, the hairs on my arms. I remember watching that episode go out and just getting it immediately. There's no mention at all of anything illegal or illicit in the entire episode.
Not whatsoever.
And yet you watch it and it's like watching, that same feeling you get watching 24 Hour Party People, or just the sort of the memories it unclogs in your head. And I'm 38 and was doing the laundry while I was watching the episode, and I was still there, just couldn't stop moving to it. Yeah. It's so great, that whole episode. Edgar Wright's, he's a clever boy, isn't he?
Yeah, but it's also Simon.
And the writing as well.
Simon
and
Jess
are
really all the way through that. You know, what you see visually is Edgar, but because Edgar's young. But what you're seeing with Simon and Jess, we used to have parties every month at our house in Kentish Town, and they were mental, you know.
Amazing.
And, you know, so there was that, you already had your shorthand. And when you used to go out, you went out clubbing as a group.
Yeah.
So then within the group, you had your little shorthand, you had your stories, and you had your little, you know, chill out room sitting around laughing. Oh. Like Big Fish, Little Fish, which was my dance that I made up for the club culture, came out of sitting around in a chill out room in a club down Stearns in Worthing.
Amazing.
Came out of that, and then parties in Camilla's around the corner in Kentish Town.
Let's just focus here. You're claiming the invention of the Big Fish, Little Fish.
Yes,
I saw you.
You're
claiming the invention.
Wow. Yes.
Listeners,
this is huge.
Yes. This is huge. This is major. We may need to run this past Mix Magazine. Well, they've got to. Because there's the little kids rave called Big Fish, Little Fish.
Well, exactly. That's how far it's come round. Well, I was doing Big Fish, Little Fish before there was Mix Mag Magazine. So
back to tyres. How much of tyres was built around you?
Nearly all of it.
Because he's a cycle courier.
I was a cycle courier. I was a DJ. I used to go out raving. I was a DJ. Mm. I had a short attention span with a short fuse. I was spiritual, but also not taking any of your shit.
Acting on the mood swings.
I was like the world's shortest tempered psychoanalysis.
And just you shared a flat with Simon Pegg. Wasn't Chris Martin living with you as well?
No.
Oh, right.
He came and visited when we moved to Highgate, and I put them out of the house one night. They came back after a party and I put Coldplay out of the house.
But
we had people coming and live with us over a period of time, mostly in Kentish Town. Mm. Kentish Town was like an open door for Waifs and Strays who were on their way up to Edinburgh. So you get comedians and performers coming over from Australia who would then stay with us for a couple of weeks, maybe a month before Edinburgh, and then go up to Edinburgh there or come back to to decompose.
decompress, either will do. Either's good. Well, Heartfloor fans you turn up in the most unexpected places. I did a thing on Nigella Lawson a few years ago on one of her cookbooks, and I said, "Are you into music?" She goes, "Oh yeah, I really love the Heartfloor mix of Blue Monday. I listen to it when I'm in Ibiza." Michael Smiley, moving on. We're going to move forward a few years to when you fall in with Ben Wheatley, the director, firstly for Down Terrace and then Kill List. What's the tune for the Kill List years?
The Kill List is I Can Hear Your Voice by The Accidental. My head's on the rack, don't know if I can look into the light, 'cause it's black and it's white. It touches like a tidal wave, it hits like a hurricane, and my head is ringing, and my head is spinning.
I Can Hear Your Voice by The Accidental. Tell us about this then. How did you come across this?
I bumped across it. I think I heard a track off that album called Wolves, and I heard it, like one of the sound engineers on Kill List had it. We were all stationed up in Sheffield filming because all the money for Kill List came from Yorkshire Screen. So it was all filmed in Yorkshire, around Sheffield, on the outskirts of Leeds and East Yorkshire. So we were all sort of staying in digs in the one big place up in the centre of Sheffield. So we'd have parties and, you know, we'd go out and get to know each other and have like just sit around drinking parties afterwards. And I think I'd heard that somewhere, and then I played it to somebody, and then I went and bought the album online. And I really love that tune because it's really easy going and it feels like slightly drippy hippy, but the lyrics are quite dark on it, which I quite like. And all the way through that album, there's quite sort of dark lyrics, which is what's in a way that, you know, Kill List was like. It lulls you into a false sense of security and makes you think, oh, maybe this is just another one of those, you know,
happy clappy torture murder movies.
Well, you don't see the murder until it's too late.
It's true, yeah.
You get a sense from the dinner party that this isn't going to finish with a song.
Yeah. They're a super group, aren't they? It's like Tongue and the Memory Band and Liam Bailey and Hannah Coughlin. It's kind of like they are the cream of acid folk.
Yeah, no, I don't know anything about them, and I've never chased them up afterwards. It was just that album, and I've got a. I'm a bit of a folk head as well, you know. I love Matt Dillon and Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and all that stuff, you know.
Sarah, have you ever had a folk horror moment? Are you a folk horror person? Because this is quite the world of Ben Wheatley, isn't it? It's kind of like,
oh god, I love Ben Wheatley.
Small seems to false sense of security. It's like it's the weirdness behind the kind of rural
I had an amazing experience when I first had my baby girl who's five now. You know, they do the sort of screenings at the cinemas when you can take your kid and they sleep, and I went to the cinema like 300 times in that first year because it was just constantly going to baby screenings. But the Ritz he had a field in England, which is amazing. I was the only person in the cinema in this parent and baby screening in the cinema with my kid who was feeding, and it was just the weird incongruity between those two things of being sort of lovely nursing mother and this nightmarish, wonderful, folky, creepy thing that was unfolding. It's just I really enjoyed that, and I had to sort of cover her eyes during the mad stroping mushroom scenes. Yeah. Other than that, I think I'm a really good parent.
Yeah, it's probably quite good for a child at a formative stage there to be, you know.
I think she mostly had her eyes closed.
And not a psilocybin horror moment.
I like the idea of just showing her all the ticket stubs one day of all the films that she saw in her first year.
That's
life.
A good idea.
Yeah. Well, I suppose the question of, like, what's the first film you ever went to see is going to be an interesting answer from her when she finally gets asked this.
Yeah, I think we saw Behind the Candelabra three times in a row at the Ritzy Parents pre-screening.
So, Michael, we're into the Luther years now. Which track have you chosen for this?
It's Step by Step by Jesse Winchester, which was off The Wire. It was one of the tracks off The Wire soundtrack. I love the dance. I like dancing. It's one of the big things in my life. I like that sort of quirky, downbeat, slightly off the beat tune. Like Tom Waits' Gun Street Girl is one of the tracks I love dancing to in my own in the house. And this is like that. It's a folky but slightly off the pace. And it's got a quasi, like, nearly religious, and it's nearly like a Christian sort of song going through it, like a gospel song. I love it. I think it's a brilliant tune.
All the happy saints go marching in. And if a saint step out of line, you have to start again. Cause Jacob's golden ladder gets slippery at the top. And many a happy-go-lucky saint has made that long, long drop. If I'm late, don't wait. Go on without me.
Step by Step by Jesse Winchester there from the Wire soundtrack. So you're on Luther. Is this you and Idris Elba just talking about The Wire the whole time?
God, no.
Really?
God, no. I never mentioned it once to him. And then one day, it was like, I think it was two series ago, and it was a big camera setup where they were running a camera, like a trolley running down the roof of the cop shop. So it was taking ages for the setup, and everybody sort of drifted off, and I was standing talking to Sam, the director, and The Wire came up, and of course I'm a mad, mad, mad Wire fan. Mm-hmm. And I just went into one about it, just talking about various series and characters and how much I loved it. And I was getting into my usual ranting style, you know what I mean? Just getting really infused about the whole thing. And then I stopped and looked at him going, he's standing behind me. And he just was going, listen, mate, 2 years, I've kept my mouth shut. Just give me a break, will you? But I was also very conscious of, which I've had at times, if something's a hit, people only ever want to talk about that one thing to you. And I'm sure, like it was a long time ago, The Wire. So to constantly, people come, and it's their first time seeing you, and they're just vomiting about that, you know. As much as, you know, I get recognised for tyres, and I look nothing like tyres, and people want to talk about space and where they were and how it was for them. And it's lovely. But if it was like that with The Wire all the time, I would be pissed off too after a while. But I think he wasn't pissed off. It was just more I was, like, having respect enough to let him get on with it, you know.
Now, finally, on our Desert Island Bubbies routine here, purely for me, you were in Rogue One, Star Wars Rogue One. Blink and you'll miss it. Actually, eyes wide open and you'll still miss it because you're under a ton of slap.
Yeah.
It's unrecognisable.
I'm playing Dr. Everson. I'm playing a heritage character because he was in the cantina scene in the original Star Wars. He's the one that goes, they say, my friend doesn't like you and I don't like you either. Mm. It was played by a London cab driver originally. And I then had to dub his voice. So the guy that had dubbed the voice was, it was really hard for me to try and do the voice because it was like an American trying to do a Cockney accent, but actually coming out as a weird sort of Scottish, British, hey, British accent.
So naturally got an Irishman in to do it because that's going to work.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think more I had the face of the character, to be honest, as the voice.
Well,
but so what happened was I got asked, would I be interested? And of course I said yes, because I said yes primarily just to excite Simon Pegg just to ring him up and go, I'm going to be in Star Wars. Just because the years of him being a big Star Wars fan and me poo-pooing it as the older flatmate going, are you ever going to grow up, big lad? So one side of that to me coming in like, just like the big brother pissed off, analogue big brother, has got no interest whatsoever in any of your, you know, your social commentary, you know. But so I got in, so it was like 5 hours of prosthetics to do this. And then at the end of it, we shot it up in Pinewood. They had to put me in like a big Obi-Wan Kenobi cape with a hood over me. And then I had to be walked out. And then they put cloths either side of the doorway to the van to get me into the van. And then taken up. Nobody was allowed to be seen. You weren't allowed to be seen. It was all great secrecy. Because they were scared that people were going to take photographs and stuff. And then I was in, coughing a spit, done the walk, done it two or three times, and I was out.
There you go.
Amazing.
Yeah. Well, I remember sort of saying it and going, oh, I know he's in it. Where is he? Where is he? And I just didn't clock you at all because there's that much plastic gunge on your face.
Yeah.
What was the tune for that then?
Well, it's a tune that's not connected to that at all, really. But I picked this because this is a tune that as soon as it comes on, my wife and I will just dance to it. Me and Miranda will just dance to it. She loves it. It's a guaranteed floor filler in our house. So it's called Woo All Right Yeah Uh-Huh.
Let's have a listen. This is the Rapture with, what's the title again?
Woo All Right Yeah Uh-Huh.
Woo All Right Yeah Uh-Huh.
Yeah, uh-huh, by The Rapture. Sarah, it's a bit overdue for you to get a choice of music. We ask all our guests to bring a tune into play. What have you got for us?
Yeah, I'd like to talk about the debut single of an artist called Katis. She's from London. It's a song called Promises, and it's out this week, and I just think it's lovely. I think she's got a really beautiful voice, like really unusual. It's very unfashionable. Like, it's not the John Lewis warbly wafty. Her voice has got balls, for want of a better word, and I could listen to it all day. And full disclosure, I'm sleeping with the producer, who is my husband, Tim Bazell.
That'll get you far in the music business, that I understand.
Exactly. It'll get you a plug on Big Mouth is what it'll get you. But I happen to also think this is really beautiful. It's one of my favourite things he's working on at the moment. She's great. It's got Corey Wong from Vulpec is playing the guitar on it, and okay. I've definitely heard of them. They are a cool band, apparently.
And what do we know about her? Is she?
What do we know? This is her debut single. She's done backing vocals for various artists. She's very talented, and I think good things are going to come from it.
Splendid. All right, let's have a listen. This is Smiley doesn't get to choose any more music because he's had loads, but this is Sarah's choice. This is Katis with Promises.
The promise will be over soon at midnight. Well, by the time you get to me, it's getting light. You promise that you're out of time, but you'll let me know when. Well, baby, if you really want it,
that was Katis with Promises, as chosen by our guest Sarah Morgan. Now, it's been a ravey old show so far, and that's not going to change because we are coming up, do you see what I did there, to the 30th anniversary of the dawn of house music. Outdoor raves, baggy fluorescent T-shirts, shouting acid and getting right on one, matey. Yes, it sounds like a million years ago. The original cheesy quavers are now in their 50s and even their 60s, but the think pieces are massing over our heads. We're going to share our rave confessions, but first we're going to talk about our favourite classic dance records, and here they are all in one big chunk. We'll be right back. where you from and what you on. You are, of course, on Big Mouth, and that was our guest's favourite classic rave tunes, and mine and Sean's as well. We had Voodoo Ray by a guy called Cherald, a splendid choice by Sarah Morgan. Mine, which is Lack of Love by Charles B., the great acid track of all for me. A proper piano banger from Michael Smiley, Passion by Gat Decor. He's been doing Big Fish, Little Fish cardboard box as we speak. And finally, Renegade Master, Fatboy Slim Mix by Wildchild, which was a hit in about 1995, but it doesn't matter because it's a banger. Firstly, Sarah, why Voodoo Ray?
It seems so basic compared to these deep cuts that everyone's got, but it's just great. And,
yeah.
And also because the sample on it is Peter Cook.
Yeah.
attempting to say Voodoo Ray and getting it a little bit.
He says Voodoo Rage.
Voodoo Rave. Yeah. Is it Voodoo Rave or Voodoo Rage?
Voodoo Rage.
It's from a not great Pete and Doug sketch, but I do remember, and I say remember, I think I'm piecing together this memory maybe from if you were there, you don't really remember it. But it's sort of being in various flats, you know, maybe about 5 in the morning with lots of joss sticks and people saying, oh, this samples Pete and Dud, who are they? This is how I got introduced into the comedy that has made me who I am. So I'm more of a comedy-o than a muso. I would have danced to anything at that time, and this song just reminds me of sort of leading into the world of things I love.
Also, the bit on Voodoo Ray, the Voodoo Ray bit is Peter Cook, but also so is the later! That is also, I did not know this, it is also Peter Cook. So something like Gerald, you know, he's Mancunian, an awful lot younger than the kind of Pete and Dud generation. It's odd to me that he knew this, but he picked it up somehow.
Yeah, it's really I love that this has sort of led on to the weird thing of just everything sampling odd things. So you had the Toy Town Techno thing that was around the corner that I found fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, Sesame's Treat and Charlie Says and God, there was a Trumpton one, wasn't there?
Yeah.
And it just felt like everyone decided at the same time that everyone was definitely on drugs all the time, whether you wanted to be or not, whether you were 5 or whether you were 60. Everyone in the early 90s was on drugs and had to be entertained all the time.
Growing up in Somerset, does this mean that, you know, Glastonbury is just immensely tedious for you? And
I've been going to Glastonbury since I was about 12, because you used to get in for free if you were under 14. So I would get the bus up and just walk in through the thing. And then there was the fence jumping years. Then there was the Workers' Beer Company years where I would pull pints.
I think I've
bought a ticket once, because now I sort of tend to go with my comedy mates who do the cabaret tent. Mm. But yeah, I can't do other festivals. Definitely spoiled me for anything else. Yeah, the little ones where they keep you in a little pen.
Yeah.
I can't do those anymore. Mm. Yeah.
Are you a semi-detached raver or a full raver?
I don't know what that means.
Did you throw yourself fully into it in the field?
Yes, I think I was. I didn't invent Big Fish, Little Fish cardboard box. I do think I invented carrying the egg dance.
Carrying
the egg dance. Yeah. That was a classic.
Carrying the egg.
Smiley's just nodded approvingly. I feel like I've been blessed by the Pope. Everyone remember carrying an egg around a dance floor? You'd pass it to your mate. You'd get it back.
It was sort of in homage to Kirsty Hawkshaw doing It's a Fine Day with her egg floating orb.
Yes! Oh my God.
So what have your favourite clubs been over the years?
I'm from Bristol, really. So Thecla and Trinity were important parts of my youth, but it was mainly Fields. I've got to say, it was mainly Fields where I no entry. Yeah, lot of us in a car going to a field.
Yeah,
how long would you stay in the field? Is that really a sunrise field? It would be
Yeah. Again, piecing together memories.
Yeah,
probably for photographic evidence more than anything else. But yeah.
Did you have a personal preferred item of rave wear?
I almost certainly had some kind of awful children's referencing backpack, like a Teletubbies or something, or Shaun the Sheep or something like that, because that was the style of the time for the certain young lady. Obviously sensible footwear, which all girls should wear clubbing. Mm. And I would freeze, I would freeze a thing of Ribena, put it in the freezer, and take it out with me and enjoy it over the night.
Sensible.
Chewing gum, Vicks, you know, all the classics.
Beautiful stuff. Michael Smiley, you wanged on about dance music quite a lot on this show, but you chose Passion, the prototypical piano banger by Gat Decor.
Yeah.
Which is like, and this almost became like the blueprint for...
It's the naked mix. It has to be the naked mix.
It's the naked mix, not the...
The other one with the vocals in it and stuff. No. It's just the stripped down naked mix is the one that works for me, because it's a fatter sound and it just rolls. And once you start with it, it just takes you and you just go with it. Close your eyes and away you go. I wasn't into the vocal one off it. So that comes from... When I was a courier, on a Friday night, every now and again, at least once or twice a month, would come out a cash job, going to Sheffield. Mm. And it used to come out at 6 o'clock. And none of the dispatch riders, a guy on the motorbikes, wanted to do it because they were already in London and didn't want to go back up the motorway. So I wangled it as a cash job for me. They paid my train fare to Leeds return. I would stop off, take the parcel to Sheffield, get back on the train, and then meet my cousin and his mates. And we'd go to Up Your Ronson on a Friday night.
Oh, wow.
And then back to Basics on a Saturday. Or sometimes we'd go to Renaissance in Mansfield or in Otley when it was in Otley as well.
Yeah.
So I'd done a lot of my early Raven days in Yorkshire.
Yorkshire was where it was happening.
But also it was, to be honest, because, yeah. Those were the days of Sasha before Sasha became self-indulgent.
Yeah.
When he was playing just that lovely rolling house that was a bit techno-y, a bit stripped back, but at the same time funky too. And this was the time of football hooligans becoming ravers, you know, because a lot of my cousins' mates were from the lead service crew who were now out hugging every year. And I would go up on a Friday and come back on a Sunday and then get back on my bike on a Monday for the Happy Mondays, where everything was just gorgeous. I had an amazing weekend.
Yeah. And followed by Suicide Tuesday.
Suicide Tuesday, yes. Terrible Tuesday, where you would just be cycling around going, New Cavendish Street, it's around here somewhere. New Cavendish Street, somebody please.
Well, subsequently, I edited Mixmag sort of a few years later in the late 90s, and there were a lot of management problems on Tuesday. A lot of hugging and
tears.
Gentle talking about how it's all going to be great, really. Don't worry, you really good at your job and you're a nice kid. There's a lot of that.
So that song came from, I heard it on the dance floor, it drove me mad. I wanted to find it, And then somebody told me it was called Gat Decor because it was the roundabout of Tag Records, Decor, Tag Records, which were in a little alleyway down the bottom of Wardour Street beside the Blue Posts, which isn't there anymore. Damn your eyes. But it was off between Rupert Street and Wardour Street. There was a little record shop there called Tag Records. And I got it from there, and it was I think it was on the Effective as well, on the Effective label.
With a big thumbs up logo.
It said Effective on it.
So that was a classic example of British DJs pretending to be sophisticated Italians, wasn't it? Because you go, oh, it's made by Italians, it's going to be great.
Yeah.
It's actually a bunch of former Barra boys who've knocked it up.
But they knew how to do it, you know what I mean? And it was like, those were the days when there was that going on, there was huge tunes, songs like Pistapache and stuff like that. They were just, I loved them because it was all quite quirky, and it was quite sort of a, you know, there was lots of hooks in the songs that made you want to go back to them, which what Italian tunes were, like FBI Project, and was like that.
And this is like the blueprint for when House came back about sort of 4 or 5 years ago, when Disclosure appeared and all that, you know, Quiche and all those things. This track, Passion, is kind of the blueprint for it.
And
I've got loads of records, that's our Passion.
And it's slower, you know, when it's slower than a lot of them. So I love that slightly dubby element. I love my dub as well.
Yeah.
So I love I love the music to wash over me. And I don't really want it to break down too much, you know. I remember going to see Chemical Brothers when they were resident at the Social.
Yeah.
And they hardly had any breakdowns. And then when you seen them, when they got bigger and bigger, the breakdowns lasted too long. You were going, it's coming up, they're coming up. No, it's not that one. Damn, fuck
out. Looking at your watch.
Fuck, I'm supposed to be loved up and I'm raging now.
Now, Sarah has confessed to her Shaun the Sheep and or Tully Tubby backpack.
Yeah, I was playing that and I said, that's a little bit too late, isn't it? Yeah.
Rave is a broad church.
Yeah.
Rave is a broad church. I want to ask you, Michael, if you're going to Up Your Ronson and Basics, the question's got to be asked, did you ever own leather kecks or a waistcoat?
No. I'd Up Your Ronson and Back to Basics.
Well, it was quite a proggy thing, that wasn't it? Quite prog house.
No, God,
still baggy and flappy around there.
It was always about the as baggy as possible, in the sense of not baggy Manchester baggy, but baggy sticky. I wanted to dance. I wanted the middle of the dance floor. And I had my head shaved for a long time, so I used to wear little skull caps that would catch the sweat. Otherwise, my eyes would swell up because I'd be rubbing my eyes with the sweat getting into my eyes. And I would always, like the party bag in Spaced, I had a party bag. It was really important to have the clothes that were dry stashed somewhere, so you would just be dripping.
That's what the backpack was for.
And then you would go and get that and get your dry clothes and
clean underpants, that kind of thing. Sean, you went with Renegade Master. The sad story of Paul Wildchild, who actually died, didn't he?
Isn't it really sad? He died just after it came out, year after it came out. And this is the Fatboy Slim remix, which sounds deeply unfashionable, doesn't it, of 98. My point being really that rave doesn't die.
Yeah.
And this is an 80s, but this still has the spirit. And obviously we've had The Social and we've had Big Beat and all that sort of stuff in the 90s. And still it continues. And it's the thing. I think there needs to be a word, if there's anybody medical listening, for all the hairs coming up on your arms. and feeling that rush. And as you say, there's something that may still be lodged in the spine coming out, everyone wanting to hop around. You just feel that. And the structure of these songs is incredible when you.
It's almost like they were designed to
trigger
really?
Yeah.
Really? Physical sensations.
But they still trigger it, don't they?
Oh,
they
absolutely.
Still have that effect, which is incredible. So it was really, it was that of the old days of listening to something you didn't like, and then something comes on and everybody's on the dance floor and everybody's smiling. Yeah. And you can be on the water for all that as well. It's just that feeling of happiness that doesn't exist anymore.
But also he's a genius. I think Norman Cook's a genius for the acid house generation because he just serves it up and it's really misses. I remember from Fried Food Funk and all those other little stuff that was coming out before he became Fat Boy Slim. And then when I realised that he was the same guy, all that stuff coming out of Brighton, I love it. I think it's brilliant. Wild Child's a great tune.
Yeah.
You know, Renegade Master's a brilliant tune.
Yeah. Well, my choice was Lack of Love by Charles B, which is a kind of burbly acid thing. And there's a sample at the start of it, which also appeared on Hallelujah, the Happy Mondays remix. I don't know whether that came first or whether Oakenfold took it from Charles B. I don't know, but there's just something so excitingly, intensely relentless and hammering about it. I'll still play it at a party and still the ears will prick up and it'll go, you know, you get that sort of, you're teleported back to a different time, but it also feels really like now. I mentioned that, the think pieces are going to be massing over our heads right now. Do we think that sort of dance music moment really did change Britain? Did it change us? You mentioned like football hooligans not being hooligans anymore. Do we think it changed things?
I think it could have. I think the fact that it was nipped, it was turned into that sort of, dare I say it, it became a social event, it became a political event, it became a criminal event. And that was the government, in my head, it was the government shit scared of people coming together and having little quiet revolutions with each other going, oh, don't be doing that, do this, that's good,
what
should do that?
That stopped people gathering?
Yeah, it was
what
a criminal was justice,
criminal justice
bill.
Yeah, that was it, yeah.
Well, a lot
yeah.
of records came out in about 1994 called, like Fuck the Criminal Justice
Bill.
Yeah.
The repetitive beats.
Yeah.
I think it could have made a big difference, and it wasn't just the MDMA. I think there was genuine, people were enjoying being in each other's company. You were going to a nightclub and you weren't feeling like I'm going to get stabbed or somebody's going to headbutt me or somebody's going to try and get off my girlfriend in front of me just to piss me off type thing.
Yeah, they were so universal as well. They're all different types of people under one roof sweating and hugging and dancing.
I was going to mention Whirligig as well. And it's still going.
I brought my kids to Whirligig when it was a Shoreditch town hall. I remember bringing Dylan, who's 34 now, Jasmine's 30, and bringing him with my wife at the time, right, and going into, and there's the, we walked in, there was all these beautiful little hippie girls with paint on their faces, you know what I mean? I walked in the door and one of them ran over and seen Dylan and picked him up and gave him a kiss and he looked at me like, I know why you come to these places.
Formative experiences. DJ Monkey Pilot still on? That's what I want to know.
Oh, probably.
Monkey Pilot's probably about 70 now, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. But that was the wonderful thing. There were babies, and then there were 90-year-olds.
Yeah.
Oh, they must do. They do the parachute at the end, which was always fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Is everyone aware of Hey Dougie and the Stick song?
I've heard of Hey Dougie.
Yes. It just feels very fitting with the subject matter that there's this kid's show called Hey Dougie that's on CBeebies, but they just did an episode about the children finding a stick, and they all sing a song, and it's called The Stick Song, and just seek it out, look at that video, and realise that it's a show made lovingly, not over the heads of kids, nothing like that, but made by people who enjoyed their time and are bringing rave back in a beautifully inclusive way. And it just really, it does the goosebumpy thing wonderfully. Yeah. It's one of the finest rave songs I've heard in a long time. And it's for kids and it's great. Yeah.
Rave in a beautifully inclusive way.
My kid loves it.
So in conclusion, as it used to say on an old bit of graffiti behind King's Cross Station, where all the converts used to meet to get their travel instructions, rave is best. This is in 4 foot high letters, rave is best. And they're not the world, that's not there, but we can conclude, can we not? Rave is best.
Yeah. Definitely.
Finally. In sharp contrast to all that.
Keep it like
the mood dips. No, it doesn't. As promised, the Sting and Shaggy album. Upon the Fields of Marley, Don't Stand So Close to Irie, Wrapped Around Your Patois, Sting is back with his new best friend, Shaggy. 448876, that's the name of the album, not Mr. Bombastic's hotel room number. Relax, girls. The title is taken from the area phone codes of the UK and Jamaica. Clever. Before we explore this lunacy, let's hear a track. Don't make me wait to love, to love, to love you. You don't want to rush and I don't want to take my time. I'm putting everything on the line. They say that true love's hard to find. I'm ready now to make you mine. Don't make me wait, baby. Now, baby, now. Don't make me wait. But that is it.
Million selling Sting there with million selling Shaggy. Wonder why the record company gave this idea the green light. OK, I admit it, it's actually not as lunatic as I had thought. Sting's plaintive melodious chords against Shaggy's Jamaican sex bez. It kind of works. It's sort of good fun. While Mr. Sting noodles around Shaggy, Shaggy adds a lot of energy to the noodling. Sarah Morgan, you could be a well-disguised Shaggy fan. What did you think?
I watched this. My eyes were opened. You never forget your first time when I was watching the Queen's Jubilee thing. It was her birthday, wasn't it? Imagine, was she 92?
She's 92, the Queen.
Imagine that was your birthday party and you have to go to the Albert Hall or wherever it was and watch Sting and Shaggy.
She's seen it all.
Singing about like grinding and stuff. But you know what?
Trying to wind you up, yeah. Your Majesty.
Yeah, like have I died? Is this the last thing I'm going to see? My time is finite.
When this hip hole died?
Yeah. They're having fun, aren't they? They look like they're fun. And I saw them being interviewed on Jimmy Kimmel, I think it was. And I think Sting is, and it might be a bit in love with Shaggy. He just can't stop touching him when they're talking. They're having such a great time when they're swapping stories and they're having a great time. And he just can't, he's like a drama teacher, like a creepy drama teacher, constantly massaging him and touching him. And I just think they're a bit in love with each other, and that's all right.
Do you think Sting wishes he was Shaggy?
Because he always had the fake Jamaican accent, didn't he?
He was totally Jamaican.
Totally Jamaican.
In a way that radio doesn't play those records in a way, because it's a little bit slightly hashtag problematic.
It's a bit don't stand so close to me.
It's a bit like, you know, are you really doing that, Mr. Sting?
Yeah. No, it's, it is like, well, Shaggy thinks it's okay. Some of Sting's best friends are Jamaican.
What did you make of the record?
It sounds like a Sting and Shaggy record. That's exactly what it sounds like. There were no surprises. They just seem like they're having fun. What are you going to do? It's not for me, but then, I don't know.
Do they care?
Do they care? They are having fun.
Michael Smiley.
Well, you know, I wouldn't have it in the house, to be honest. Wouldn't have it in the house. Wouldn't have it in the airways at all. Sting gives me the dry bulk. It just makes me wretch every time I look at him. I can't get it out of my head, that tantric sex that he has with that the missus, whatever she's called, Stylus or whatever.
Trudy Stylus.
So then Shaggy is a wee bit, whatever.
No warmth towards Shaggy.
I don't mind a bit of bombastic, don't get me wrong. Yeah. But, you know, I don't want it all the time. Take your boom somewhere else, mate.
So, I don't know, is this Sting's album or is it Shaggy's? Where is it going? Is it going to Shaggy audience, Stingy audience?
Are they the same now? Is it just people who listen to like Magic FM? That's a good Sting.
It's
magic that we play Sting and Shaggy at the same time. It's like Absolute Radio. It's a kind of Absolute Radio kind of.
Is it something that's like
Matt? It's definitely a man who's wearing this record.
They both helped each other get us to remember them.
You know, I didn't find this as grossly offensive as Michael does, because I've got a lot of love for Shaggy. Shaggy did one of the most amazing things I've ever seen on stage. I saw him in New York, and his band started playing, and the MC came on and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I got some bad news. Shaggy's been detained at immigration at JFK. He's not going to play. The band's going to play. We're trying to get him out and get him into the show." And the audience is going, what? Then the MC comes out 5 minutes later and says, "Ladies and gentlemen, Shaggy has broken out of immigration, but he's gone AWOL and he's at name of famous Jamaican restaurant in Bushwick." And the crowd's going, whoa! Disappears. The band continues playing. I'm playing a fantastic medley of old, like, you know, old reggae classics. Then the MC comes on again and goes, "Shaggy's latest been seen in name of famous chicken shop somewhere else." He's just naming all the
This is showbiz.
The audience is now well on board. Well, the coup de grace is when the MC comes on and goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm terribly sorry." This is after 10 minutes of more and more build up, and people get more and more raucous. "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm terribly, terribly sorry. Obviously, I'm not going to do the accent of the MC because I'm not Sting. terribly, terribly sorry. I'm afraid we've totally lost track of Shaggy. I don't think he's going to be able to play tonight. So we're just going to have to entertain you as best we can." At which point, Shaggy flies out of the wings in a pearl white suit with no shirt on beneath. The jacket is open. The diamonds and the gold are all flying. He launches himself through the air, snatches the mic from the MC's hand and goes, "They call me Mr. Boombastic." And the roof comes off and the band goes straight to it. And it was showmanship on a James Brown level. Everybody was in on it as well. They all knew it was a load of bullshit, but it was so beautifully done. So I've had a lot of time with Shaggy ever since that. This is a bit Milky Bar reggae, isn't it? It's a bit, I think friend of the show Dorian Linsky once described somebody's effort at reggae making Hardfi sound like Burning Spear. It's a little bit like that. But there is a weird bit of humour in there, like getting Shaggy to sing it in the Shaggy voice, "The time has come, the world was said to talk of many things," and then have Sting reprise it by going, "The time has come, as Shaggy said." Talk about it. Like, there's a gag in here somewhere. I can't get my hand on it.
It's so lovely.
I agree. I probably wouldn't play this ever again. But I don't think it's a war crime.
Is it a political album? I've only heard the single off it.
The political element is they released it on 420. Yeah.
What? Hitler's birthday?
No!
420. I know. Yeah.
Oh my God, it's Hitler's birthday. Yeah, maybe not. No, the other 420.
The other thing that people celebrate.
Absolutely.
Think about.
Yeah. So it's basically a 21st century version of Legend by Bob Marley, isn't it? It's nice. Like there for your polytechnic lecturer reggae needs, I think.
Felt there were a theme of ebony and ivory as well coming in, as we're bringing the world together because one of us is like, one of us is black, get it? You know, it's like, okay.
I had been holding a torch out though for 2 hours of maximum slackness with Sting and Trudy though. A message to you, Trudy. Full on, filthy, sex, reggae.
Really?
Yeah. No, actually. No.
What was good? It made me go and listen to King Tubby. Because I thought, I'm not having this anymore.
Have a sorbet of Tubby, please. Tubby sorbet.
So it did that, which was very good.
Tubby boo-hoo.
They sing about being poor, though, and doing the night shift. I didn't like that stuff. Yeah. Ooh,
maybe
the
that
night
is the night shifting, what you did at that gig in New York. Like,
maybe it is.
I think Shaggy probably still has got a genuine connection to the sufferers. Yeah, people who are enduring sufferation.
Like Springsteen.
I mean, he might be rich, but
he's still blue collar.
Yeah. Sting, well, he was a teacher, wasn't he?
Yeah, so he knows dry bug.
Well, the clock is running down. We're going to put Sting and Shaggy out of our minds very quickly. It means it's time for closing time chatter. How are our guests going to break the ice over an elderflower and lime martini this weekend? Sarah Morgan, what's your closing time chatter?
Oh, I've just been enjoying talking about the weird photo of Kate and Wills on the steps after they had their baby. Well, baby. We had a whole baby.
What, did they have a baby?
Lovely. It was very moving.
Prince Frogmiller.
And I'm not anti-monarchy at all. I don't like anti-royal family. I think even if you dislike them and you, the people who share pictures of the mad people who sit outside the hospitals for 15 hours waiting on them, you're still sort of joining in with the whole thing. But I was really sort of, I've been talking lots with friends of mine about how odd that photo was of seeing a woman who's just given birth, like literally in the space of a few hours given birth, sort of being wheeled out onto the steps of a hospital wearing a red dress, which felt a little bit Handmaid's Tale, but also it sort of gave away the truth of what that takes to make a woman who's just given birth look like a human being who's probably coming down off an awful lot of opiates. And if she was not, then she's really destroyed. Like, she's in so much pain, so physically wrecked. She's had something removed from her body that doesn't feel like it should be removed from your body. And yet she's been sort of like spray painted and the hair looks like a wig. And it's a bit like they sort of, this is maybe a bit extreme, but it looks like they sort of dressed up a corpse for an open casket. And yet every single person who sort of responded, I know has responded, we've all just gone, John Humphreys on the Today Show said something like, well, I bet there's a lot of mothers who are a bit jealous that she can snap back and look so great after that. And I don't know a single mother who looked at that picture and didn't just go, oh, no, no, poor woman. Oh, no, you wouldn't want to have to do that, would you? You want to have to put on your makeup and brush your hair and act like a person. Awful. So I really have just been enjoying the response of the women of the world and people who are humans of the world looking at that photo and going, we shouldn't do this to people. Even if you don't like the royal family, you shouldn't make someone do that. It looks weird and wrong.
Would it have gone over better if she'd staggered out in a gown, pale and sweaty, holding up and look, there it is. Are you happy now?
Yeah,
happy?
Just been a person going, I'm wearing four nappies right now. Or just been able to get in a car and leave.
Yes.
The sort of, I like the absolute strangeness of something looking too normal. I'd really enjoy that seemed like a really it was very enjoyable to discuss and made me realize the world is changing and everyone's going, no, don't do that to people.
That drives me insane. It just drives me insane, all this distraction from the fact that they're dismantling the NHS in front of office. Look, there's a royal, they're going to be dancing, she's going to wear something nice, they're going to pop a baby out, watch this one, he's going to do a roly-poly, you know. It's, and meanwhile the country's going to hell in a handcart.
Yeah.
Poor people are getting poorer, and the distance between the haves and the have-nots are getting wider and wider and wider, and it breaks my heart. So when I see a royal holding a baby, I just think, what other policies are being waved away?
We do need a Big Mouth Royal correspondent. Sean Pattenden, what's your closing time chatter?
On to something slightly different. I was looking at Frank Black on an album sleeve or something the other day and thought, oh, for goodness sake, why has Jack Black not thought that he could play Frank Black in the new miniseries? We could put it on Netflix, Amazon Prime, other places are available, and do some sort of, Todd Haynes directing, do some sort of Pixies sort of sitcom or something like that, and sort of just really blow it up, and we could all, you know.
What, like an American version of Slade in Residence?
Yes, absolutely. Just have some fun with it. And I thought, that's amazing. Who has not thought of this amazing thing? Jack Black, Frank Black, come on. Kim Deal, I'm having a bit of a problem with. Who could be Kim Deal? Oprah Winfrey, I thought. Ben Stiller could be Joey Santiago. Drummer could be a drummer. Or we could do it with Dolls or something like that. That's my new project, I think.
Yeah, get
you. Missed a trick,
haven't they? I think you need to write this down and pitch it to someone. And you shouldn't be saying this in front of me. I might nick it.
Right, okay.
A good idea has no parents.
What's the title?
Mm. Oh, that's the next step. Yeah. Elevator pitch.
Yeah. And my closing time chat is a very simple one. Roy of the Rovers is coming back. They're bringing back Roy of the Rovers, the great football comic. Roy Race of Melchester Rovers will be returning. Going to be written by Rob Williams, who writes Suicide Squad and Judge Dredd at the moment. They're doing it properly. It's Rebellion, who have owned 2000 AD, and they're buying up all the old comics like Battle and things like that.
Oh, I loved Battle and Action.
Well, I reckon your lad Paddy, Roy of the Rovers, could be the thing, because they're going to be contemporising it. Right. It's going to be contemporary football issues like scouting of new players, financing football teams. Melchester, you know, Melchester Rovers.
Is it coming back as a comic, or is it going to be a programme, or is it going to
It's coming back as. They're going to do 3 graphic novels per football season.
Right.
So, like, sort of long comic stories about Roy and Melchester. I think Melchester might be on slightly hard times, and Roy's got to save their bacon. Powerful stuff, you know, about bringing back the legend. And I think that's really healthy, because now that football is so rich and divorced from most people's experiences, and you see a talented kid get picked up and transformed into somebody who can't relate to his family's background anymore, I think you need to have something that puts football back the way it was in the 70s, when players were called things like Vern and smoked fags at
half time. Fag and half an orange.
Yeah, and at the end of it, when they retired, they opened a pub. That kind of thing. So I'm excited to see what Roy the Rovers
died of cirrhosis.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was great player.
Good old days.
Dead at the age of 48, yes. So I'm dead interested, and I think your lad, Michael, might be interested in this.
He would be, I think so. I think he's starting to get into graphic novels. He's a massive Grime fan.
Oh, right.
He'd done a whole rap in front of his posh school last night. He'd done Hangman by Dave in front of his posh schoolmates last night, which is hilarious.
Teachers at the back sort of writing sort of intervention.
No, I think they just look, I'm going, that's wonderful. I don't understand a bloody thing. He seems to be enjoying himself.
Well, that's the main thing, yes. And that, I believe, is the end of the show. Thanks to our guests. Sarah Morgan, what are you up to next? What's next on your thing?
Writing my own secret project. So I'm enjoying that a lot.
Mm. Yeah. What's your secret project?
It's actually a sitcom about Frank Black. they all live in a house. It's going to be great.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
Fair dues. Michael Smiley, you've got your Music Obsession Return to Ireland movie on the go. What else is happening?
Work on that again, and I've got a couple of films coming up in Ireland.
All right.
See, I've got 3 or 4 films coming up in Ireland if they all pan out.
Have you done Game of Thrones? Yes, every other person in Ireland has. Cab drivers in Ireland have done Game of Thrones.
I haven't, but I'm getting the spin-off from it, because all the camera crews that have cut their teeth in Game of Thrones have turned Ireland this hotbed of production. Yes. So there's a lot of good crew around in Ireland, north and south.
Okay.
So Game of Thrones has really helped in that way.
Also, imagine the Brexit's going to do a massive favour to the Irish film industry.
Which is the hard and the soft border. What are we going to do? I do love a hard border.
Are you following the Irish border on Twitter?
No.
It's got its own Twitter account.
Has it?
And it says, follow me, because you can't find out where I am. And there's another Twitter account called Good Friday Agreement, and the Irish border said, meet my dad. So it's worth following.
Your ma's your da.
Yeah, absolutely. At Border Irish. Thanks to Sean, as ever, and to producer Jack Claremont. Don't forget, dear listener, you can hear this show and all of our past pod episodes at audioboom.com/bigmouth. And if you want to support the show, you can buy us that virtual pint via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. Thanks to all of our guests. Thanks to Sean and Jack. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you again next week. Goodbye.